ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
If wealth inequality gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the super rich, the very rich, take a bigger and bigger, bigger share of the wealth, the biggest consequence of that is unaffordable housing. Living standards will fall for ordinary Australians.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to the Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney.
In Sydney, and I'm in Sydney too, face to face, PK. So good.
It is good. It's not only good, it's important, Fran. It's important for us to come together.
It's not only good, it's so good.
It's so good. We are in Sydney and we are flying balloons of budget happiness because the budget is, well, it's not. It's still a bit of time off, but it's at that point where, so the Expenditure Review Committee, as it's known, the ERC, which is a special subcommittee of the Cabinet, it's meeting very regularly trying to design what this budget will look like. If you talk to people on background, off the record, they will admit to you that this is their biggest test, their most important budget, really, the fifth that Jim Chalmers will deliver. And there's a lot of kite flying, Fran. It's the season of putting the ideas out and seeing, is a consensus growing in the community? Is this going to work? Are we going to be able to sell this thing? Is that what it's looking like to you?
That's definitely what it's looking like. We've been there before. We see this happening. And the kite that we're going to be talking about is the capital gains tax. We're going to talk about that a little later. As you say, there's a lot going on in the pre-budget area at the moment. Dealing with intergenerational inequity is the buzzword. We're hearing that from the government and also now particularly from the new Shadow Treasurer, Tim Wilson. But PK, it's more than just a buzzword. It's mission critical for our political leaders, and removing the capital gains tax fits squarely into there. It could be a bit of a solution, but even more important, I think, rather than it posing a big solution, making houses more affordable and all that sort of stuff, it's the vibe, right? It's the vibe.
So this isn't a new kite. This is obviously an old kite. This is a kite that kind of gets taken out of the...
Do you think we're labouring the metaphor here?
I labour most things, let's be honest. I've been in labour a couple of times and I'm not afraid to labour anything. Not just Jim on his own.
Let's get into that in a minute, because the other big theme this week was, we spoke about it last week, the ISIS brides, the opposition really keen to keep this topic in the headlines. They pushed it even further this week. I think, personally, to the point of overreach, but I wonder what you think. They proposed these new laws that would criminalise anybody assisting the return of Australians with terrorist links. This is all, again, as everything seems to be at the moment, PK, against the backdrop of the One Nation surge in the polls. We're going to get into that later. And with the Farah by-election imminent, that's the first federal test for Angus Taylor's leadership, things are starting to take shape. And right in the thick of it this week is our very own Jacob Greber, the 7:30 political editor, and he's your Monday Politics Now co-host. He wasn't with you this Monday because he's been in Farah, embedded, finding out stuff, and he's going to be joining us from the Wagga studios in a while.
Yes, he's been on the ground, which is why he skipped out on Monday, too busy actually doing a bit of shoe leather journalism, as it's known, you know, the old talking to actual real people.
Knocking on doors.
Who would have thought it? So we will talk to him in a moment. But in the meantime, let's talk about the economy. I mean, we talked about the budget and the flying of the kites and all of that.
Well,
but
let's talk about that kite a bit. Let's talk about that kite, because the capital gains tax is everywhere at the moment, right? There's a Senate Select Committee on it. There's a whole lot of people fronting up, almost all of them, not all of them, the housing industry bods aside, but almost all of the former Reserve Bank governors, former heads of Treasury, economists after economists after economists saying, get rid of it. You don't need it. And it does seem now there's a story suggestion in the Fin Review today that Treasury's actually got a proposal to cut it from a 50% discount on the capital gain to 33%. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, there's a whole lot of questions around it, how much money it would raise and, importantly, what the government does with the money.
Yes!
So let's pull that apart a bit. Do you think they're going to do it?
Okay. So I had the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, on Afternoon Briefing on Wednesday, and I was absolutely emotionally, psychologically and journalistically obsessed with what that looks like. He has absolutely confirmed that the capital gains tax discount is something he's looking at. Confirmed. There is no denial. Katie Gallagher's backed him in.
Well, I think the PM and the Treasurer in recent months have made it clear we are interested in looking at the issues around equity issues around intergenerationally, around housing. There is an inquiry underway that the Liberals and Greens established in the Senate. They'll report in March and we will have a look at their report when it's tabled. But, you know, we are interested in that. We should be looking at it. We've been trying to look. You know,
others are
sure
talking about it like, yep, that's what we're looking at. So that in and of itself, I think we need to note, is a significant shift from the language of, you know, sort of smoke and mirrors. Yeah. Then I wanted to nail down, is this just you're looking at this one measure and then you grab whatever revenue they get from it, which I'm not certain of. They obviously have different figures based on what they could put the discount on.
Depends what they do.
Correct.
Whether they put a sunset clause or whatever.
You know, the grandfathering, when it starts applying, all of these caveats and different changes and design can be very different in terms of what you generate for revenue. I wanted to know, do you bank the money? Do you just put it into your budget because you're spending so much? And they are. They can't deny it. Record levels since the 80s, with the exception of the pandemic. And I think they love to talk about the pandemic because they're like, that's the Morrison government. They spent a lot. Well, of course they did. It was a pandemic.
Yep.
So let's, you know, put that aside. And he was deliberately hedging because they're keeping all options on the table. My big question to him was, do you get the money and then redistribute it essentially? Do you give it back in the form of tax cuts? Because if you're dealing with intergenerational unfairness, it's not just taking away a perk that perhaps richer people, older people, whoever people are getting. It's also about then doing something with the money, which involves putting money in the pockets of young workers who are the ones that are being disadvantaged in our tax system. On that, he kept the door open, but he wouldn't commit. I think the instinct has been, we want the money.
Save the money.
Yeah?
Yep.
But that is a political risk, I think, for the government to look like it's just a tax and grab exercise rather than something systemic, Fran.
Yeah, I think that would be an own goal from the government to do that because they're already under pressure about being tax and spend. I mean, PK, with the new shadow treasurer, Tim Wilson, out and about, he's really putting the pressure on the government about the inflation numbers this week and they were going in the wrong direction.
Until the government stops pouring debt petrol onto the inflation fire, the cost of household groceries will continue to go up. The cost of the supermarket.
That means there's pressure on interest rates. Tim Wilson is really going for broke on this. We're sort of back in the land of debt and deficit talk. I'm expecting to see the debt truck come around the corner any moment now. The opposition is back on this focus and the government can't afford to give them any more ammunition, add to the spending, add to their high levels of government spending. So I think you're right. That's what they'd like to do with every fibre of their body. Mm. But if they don't come up with some kind of tax relief, other tax measure, this doesn't constitute tax reform. It is, as you said, just simply tax and grab. And no one put it better this week, I don't think, than the one of Labor's own, former ACTU Secretary Bill Keltie, who fronted up to that Senate Select Committee.
People go out of their way to avoid it. I mean, actually, I go out of my way to avoid it. I think most members of Parliament go out of their way to avoid it. It is not there for payment. It is there for avoidance. So if you want a better tax system for an aspirational Australia, it's better to reduce the margin. Make people make decisions based on the economic reality of the decision, not the tax advantage of the decision.
Bill Keltie there ringing the bell saying, you can't just do this, you've got to do that. This He was particularly focused on the income tax levels because, of course, it's working Australians and therefore younger Australians who are paying income taxes at higher and higher levels with bracket creep, and that's what the government's done very well out of over the last few years. Then there's pretty much agreement across the board now that our income tax levels need some reduction. I think the instinct from the Treasurer will be to give a little bit more to that Stage 3 tax cut that he already gave before the election, just a little bit more. It's $10 a week now maximum. It'll be a little bit more. I think if that's all he does, I don't think that will sort out or placate either the economists, who are asking for something much more significant in terms of reform, and it won't do much to quieten the shadow treasurer either. What do you reckon?
Yeah, well, look, I think if they went just to the grab the revenue and that's it, bank it,
they'd be in real trouble politically, I think.
Well, I think you can hear the campaign from the opposition already. Now, a lot of people will say, who cares about the opposition? Well, I don't know, Tim Wilson, you know, he's a pretty effective messenger as the shadow treasurer now. They are already getting ready. They're getting all of their ducks in line. I think they've been much more consistent on this message, which is no higher taxes on housing.
And not only that, Tim Wilson is really goading the treasurer. We mentioned this last week. He's really goading Jim Chalmers. He talks about him being incremental and tinkering around the edges. He talks about him, this government under him as treasurer, you know, stoking the fires of inflation. He's calling him Pyro Jim. You know, he's really suggesting and pushing this thing that Jim Chalmers hasn't really achieved much. He's just a really cautious, careful guy in a cautious, careful government that are there for their own longevity, not for the people.
Yeah. And I think they're alert and alarmed to the politics that could come back, especially if they are, you know, inverted commas, breaking a promise of, you know, we're not going to mess with the tax system now in the second term, building a case for changing things that they hadn't really told you about at the election. It's not on the agenda at the election. Let's not forget that. Now, I personally think government should be able to do things and build a case, but you can't get away from the fact that they didn't tell us about it. And so if they are able to make it, to kind of construct a tax package that, you know, explains why you're benefiting more broadly and they're really shaking things up, I think they can sell it. However, one caveat, right? If they are able to do that, let's not forget that the way they design that, Fran, will have to be very careful because of inflation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the cost of living, you know, we've said it to a blue in the face, is the number one issue. Anthony Albanese, more than perhaps anyone in the parliament, understands that and knows that. And that's why he and his treasurer, their message to their ministers and also to the treasury in this past week is, you know, we want you to look at the budget and not look at it through a political lens, look at it through an economy lens, because this is not a time for handouts and subsidies, except that's what people want and expect from a government when they're under cost of living pressure, right? But if they do that, they get back into this, you know, big spending, careless government mode that's only going to blow back on you with higher interest rates. So how is he going to construct this budget?
It's really tricky, and we got some really strong signs from him yesterday. Again, I'm quoting my interview, but I just was really trying to push him on the level of belt tightening that we're going to see, the cuts to spending, for instance. And he just went there. Like, he's trying to get us ready for it, right? Get us ready for what might be a bit of a brutal budget, that, you know, the budget has to be constructed for the times and inflation is a big issue. And so what does that mean? He concedes that there have to be significant spending cuts.
So what will they look like?
Well, that's the bit that, you know, watch the leaks. I think in the next couple of weeks, and some of them will be orchestrated, the government will want you, this is me explaining the way the politics will work, they won't want a shock and awe budget. It's not in their interests for us to get up one day and, you know, 2014 style and just go boom, boom, bash over the head.
It's not in their character either.
Exactly. So they need us to know and get ready for, as he used, he repeated my phrase and why I think that's significant, which is belt tightening. Sometimes politicians want to avoid that. They don't want to go get into that kind of frame. He wanted to lean into it because he wants you as a voter and a taxpayer to know that some of the largesse is going to come off, that he has to do it.
Oh, there'll be belt tightening in the budget. We've made that really clear. And there has been belt tightening in the first four budgets as well. But will
it be, and that's why he's briefing the old, you know, this is not about politics, it's about the economy, you know, because politics is not tightening belts. You know, when you tighten belts, you're taking something from people. There are losers. People get cranky and, you know, rightfully so. If you're about to lose a benefit that you were getting, you're going to get cranky, Fran.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, it can work the other way. Remember Kevin Rudd campaigned against John Howard as an economic conservative, you know, yes. A safe pair of hands, letting people know he's not going to go on a spend-a-thon, I think was the word back then. You know, that can work for you too, but mostly they don't want to hand the opposition any more ammunition. Right. Now, I guess that's not number one concern for them perhaps at the moment because they have such a huge majority, but they are very, very alert to it. But I'm still interested in where those cuts might be because he's ruled out, I think, cuts to health and defence, so it's not going to be in those huge chunks of budget. I imagine it'll be like some of the, I don't know, the green energy subsidies or things like that. He might wind back a bit. I don't know.
There are lots of areas where I think they'll be winding back. I asked one key question where I thought I was just really struck by the answer. And the question was, I wanted to know where the frontline services potentially would be impacted. And I thought it was really interesting that he didn't rule that out.
And when you say frontline services, you mean Centrelink?
Things that you notice. That's like, I know it's a silly way to put it, but you know, spending that you notice because you're interacting with it. Yes, Centrelink. Yes, maybe health. I don't know. Like they're spending more on the hospital agreement, but you know, like things that where you get a cutback of some sort. And he wouldn't rule it out. Now, I think that's smart, by the way. He doesn't want to get into the rule out game. However, it shows that they know that they can't be promising much at the moment.
It's true. And we're going to be talking about this a lot between now and the May budget. So let's pause now and go to the big electoral test facing the budgets, the electoral test facing the government, the big electoral test facing the new Liberal leadership and the coalition generally is the Farah by-election. And who better to talk to us about that than our very own Jacob Greber. Jacob, hello. How's our Farah correspondent?
Hello, I'm well, thanks. We've rushed in. We've just come off the highway. We were travelling really all week through Farah. And technically speaking, we're now in Riverina. I'm talking to you from our Wagga office. Ah. But we have just crossed the border, the political border.
You're living your best life. All right, give me the lowdown. What's happening in Farah? What's going to happen? You know better than anyone.
Well, okay. So I think it's so much fun to get out into these electorates and out of that building that I work in every day. Not saying it's a terrible place, but you just get a sense being out here that people are really up for a by-election. They are licking their lips at the prospect of not only having a new choice, lots of candidates to think about, and we actually don't know the names of most of them, and that's a key point we can come back to. But they're really excited that they can get the issues that they care about in front of a bit of a national audience for the first time, really, in a quarter of a century. That just doesn't happen. Farah is one of those seats where, you know, people like us really don't give it much thought because it doesn't change hands. It stays with one side of politics, rock solid. I think this moment is very different.
Yeah, in fact, more than 25 years, right? Susan Lee was there for 25 years, wasn't she? Mm. And Tim Fischer before then.
Yeah, so the story is Tim Fischer, who famously was known as Two-Minute Tim because of the way he moved around the electorate at a tremendous pace. He was there for a good quarter of a century, that sort of length of time. The member prior to that had also held it for that kind of time. Susan Lee was the third member. Famously, of course, a Liberal who, quote unquote, took it away from the National Party. And so here we are. It's really one of those big moments in the history of this seat where the floor is open for anyone to win it.
Okay. Well, what are the issues that are going to take centre stage on that floor? You say they're chomping at the bit, the electors, the voters, to get their issues out. What are the issues?
So, and this is what's interesting about the seat. It depends which bit you're in. If you're in Albury, which is the main population centre, it's really about healthcare and services. That is the number one issue. There's a big row about the hospital there. There's a big concern about the lack of mental health care services. And of course, Albury is traditionally, I think, conservative in the sense that it's not a place that's backed radicals or outsider voices. It's a much more established community. And I think that's where someone like Michelle Millthorpe, who's the independent there, she runs in the colour orange. So whatever you do, don't call her a teal. and just across the river, of course, is Helen Haynes in Indi. And But there are nuances between even those two campaigns, I would say. So that's Albury. The big issue there, healthcare. Come out into the country, go west, and it's water, 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 as is always the case. There's still a lot of anger about the way water is allocated, the buybacks, the effect of those changes on the towns, places like Deniliquin, which we travel to. You really get that powerful sort of impact. Griffith is the same, although there are differences. For instance, between Griffith and Albury, a candidate that does well in one doesn't always nail it in the other town as well. And I think just the final thing, really interesting. I met Kelly Crosley, so she's the deputy mayor of Deniliquin, and she's very much all about getting the issues of childcare sorted in that town. It's not the biggest town on earth, but they have this terrible shortage of childcare, and they're losing families from that town because those people just can't make it work without that sort of service. So these are the issues that are bubbling away.
So there's a lot of discussion about whether the Libs are on the cusp of losing this seat, which will obviously be problematic for Angus Taylor as the new Conservative leader. It's quite contested, though. I spoke to John Black the other day, who's, former Labor senator, demographer, studies this sort of stuff, and he thinks it's really overstated that they're on the cusp of losing. How do you see that, Jacob? Because, we hear One Nation is on the rise too. That's a very different kind of vote, isn't it, to the independent you just talked about?
Just before you start, Jacob, just to fill people in, it looks like being a four-person contest at least, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I watched that interview with John Black that you did the other day. I'm not sure. So the problem is we don't know the names yet. We do know the name of the very prominent independent, as I mentioned, Michelle Millthorpe. Everyone knows her name in the electorate, I got the impression. She ran last time in 2025, and she got something like 20% of the primary. She did very, very well in Albury, 2PP vote there, well into the 60s. People know who she is. I have to say, she is up and running. She's moving around the electorate. She's got her team around her. They've tooled up. They've got their campaign directors. They're moving fast. So they're out of the blocks well ahead of everyone else. The rest of the parties, of course, are still, I think Labor's very much torn as to whether it should run or not. We can talk about that. And then you've got the Liberals, the Nationals, and One Nation are all still scrambling to get going. I think they've all been caught a little bit flat-footed by this. Of course, Susan Lee hasn't yet actually formally resigned to the Speaker, Milton Dick. That has to happen so the writs can be issued. And so they're busy trying to work out who their candidate will be. And I think this is a very dangerous moment for the coalition in this seat of Farah.
Yeah, in the seat itself, their leader was rolled. And how's the feeling about that? There's been a bit of analysis about whether there'll be a backlash to her being dumped. Does anyone care?
It's funny. I kept asking everyone I met that question. How cross will people be about the way Susan Lee was treated? And I think there are some voters who do feel that she was hard done by. I think there's also voters who were disappointed in Susan Lee over the years here. And I think that happens sometimes when you're in a seat for a long time, that sense of being taken for granted takes hold. I think there's a bit of that sitting there as well. Whether that turns into a backlash against the Liberal Party, that'll depend on who they run, I guess. But it's more complicated than just, we're really annoyed that you wiped out our local member after she only got 9 months in the job.
Will it depend on who the Liberals or the Nats run, or are the polls, the national polls, which are telling us that One Nation is on the tear, is One Nation a real and present danger for the coalition in the seat of Farah? Were you able to gauge that? Because I noticed that Judy Brewer, who's the wife of the late Tim Fisher, as you mentioned, long time, very popular member for Farah until his death, She weighed in, reminding us all that her husband never thought that the, quote, dumb and divisive One Nation was the answer for a seat like Farah. But how real is that? What's the sentiment or feeling? Could you gauge that at all? Are people talking about it?
Look, you pass through these places quite quickly, so I wouldn't say anything that I say is based on heavy scientific evidence. Mm. I didn't get that sense, though, and I think it's because, again, Albury is not the same as the rest of the electorate. People would talk to me saying they were worried about some of the immigration rhetoric. The immigration rhetoric, I'm wondering how that plays in a place like Griffith, which, quite frankly, I have to tell you, is one of the most multicultural-looking towns ever come to. Yeah. Quite extraordinary. You know, it famously used to be the Italian community, but you could say now it's, you know, it's there's Pacifica people, there's people from the Indian subcontinent. It's an incredibly mixed place. And, of course, the economy there just would cease to function if you shut immigration down. It would shut down overnight. So I'm interested to know whether that One Nation rhetoric that we've been hearing, how that plays in that electorate. Now, of course, One Nation's hoping that the economic grievances people have bring those people to them because they're disappointed with the coalition. I don't think it's as cut and dry as the national polls imply. And I do think it'll depend on who they get to run, how well-known that person is, and, of course, how much Pauline campaigns in the seat as well, because she's a draw card, I'd have to say, for quite a lot of people that we spoke to, and how she's deployed in here will matter.
Now, the Prime Minister made his way to Farah. What was that all about? They're not even necessarily going to run a candidate, right? Like, he's just trying to mess with everyone's mind and try to remind everyone that the Liberals rolled their female leader, isn't he?
It did set off quite a bit of chatter around the place, among, I guess you'd call, the political class, especially in Albury. It was a quick and dirty sort of visit. He did a press conference at one of those Medicare clinics, and he didn't show up in front of the broader gallery, I guess. Well, he's miles away from the broader gallery, but he also didn't really go and meet too many of the local politicians, councillors, mayor. He certainly didn't meet the mayor. The mayor was very, very annoyed that the Prime Minister had come to town and hadn't reached out at all. He let his feelings be known about that. But I think there's a bit of psyops going there with Albanese's visit. Labor got about 14% in 2025, last year in May. That 14%, the question is, can they get that kind of a result again? Are they going backwards? And what do they do with those preferences? What's the point of them running? And I think there's a couple of different views. One is, there are other seats where Labor hasn't run in the past, such as Cook, for instance. There's the view that Labor should always offer voters the option of Labor, even if it's never going to win. You know, there's a sort of respect to the local Labor community. There's a moral argument that's sort of, I guess I put that in air quotes, a moral argument from the likes of Bob Carr and Peter Beattie, who say Labor needs to run so they can run preferences against One Nation. Whatever else happens, keep One Nation out, is the argument there. I think actually Labor has a genuinely difficult decision to make here about what it wants the outcome to be and how does it play its hand of whether it runs at all.
Well, we'll know soon enough, I guess. Depends when Susan Lee's going to go to the Speaker and lodge her retirement form. Jacob, plenty of other stuff going on. I'm sure you're keeping tabs on it because I know the creature that you are. The Prime Minister and the Treasurer were definitely, I think, looking on trying to redirect the story away from the so-called ISIS brides this week. You know, the PM came out saying Australia was proudly the first to put up their hand to say, yes, we'd support the removal of Prince Andrew from the royal line of succession.
His Majesty, King Charles, has said that the law must now take its full course. There must be a full, fair and proper investigation, and that needs to occur. I've written to Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and I've engaged with him as well directly overnight to confirm that my government would agree to any proposal to remove him from the line of royal succession.
There was that. There was also budget leaks, which Pika and I have been talking about. But the opposition, it seemed to me, to be determined to try and keep the heat on this story. And they came up with this new legislation they're proposing to make it a criminal offence, punishable with 10 years in prison, for people or organisations to assist the IS-linked people coming home, to insist anyone who's engaged with terrorism coming back to Australia. Ted O'Brien, he says the self-managed returns are, quote, a loophole that needs to be closed. Non-government organisations like Save the Children could be potentially caught up in this. Jamal Riffey, who we know is over there at the moment, he's a doctor from Western Sydney. He's a leading Australian. He's a great leader for social cohesion and community cohesion in Australia. He's over there trying to, he says he's the passport deliverer, the passport message boy, trying to help these women and children get home. Someone like he could be captured under these laws. I wonder what both of you think, because it looked to me like overreach. The government was trying just to dismiss it as, yeah, you know, as like a stunt. What do you think, Jacob?
Look, I go back to that comment I made about a place like Griffith and even Albury. There was a bit of a sense of that's not who we are as a country. Mm. Now, One Nation, of course, is going hard on immigration. And so there's been a real decision in the Liberal Party under Angus Taylor to not let that stand unchallenged. And they want to be seen to be able to play in that space just as hard. And so I'm not surprised that they came up with this policy. I mean, I think it was attacked pretty quickly as unworkable and sort of questionable, I guess, legality even, and how would you even do it in practice? And of course, we, you know, there was the that group that has been trying to help these wives and the kids get out, pointing out that it's a pretty wild thing to be targeted like that. But the politics, of course, I think they're all testing the ground here. They're trying to figure out what resonates. It's that old thing in politics. You throw it all at the wall and see which bit sticks. And I think that's what the Liberal Party is trying to do here under the new leadership. They're trying to find the line that lights up their base, that brings people back to them who are drifting to One Nation.
And just on that, what resonates, I don't know if either of you have heard this yet, but this bit of an interview with one of the children stuck in the camp. I think she's was born in the camp, this child. Mm. And I found it absolutely heartbreaking.
It is.
I wonder if something like that, hearing from a child like that who just wants to get home to Australia, wants to go to school, would change people's attitudes.
I think that the children angle, and remember there was also a story that, you know, perhaps the mothers would be happy for the children to come without them. Now, that's very fraught, so I'm not giving a view there, but it is very fraught to separate mums and kids, I think. Parents and kids, but the fact that they are children who are being punished for the sins of their parents makes us all uncomfortable. Will it change the public's view? Fran, the politics here is so out of control, inflamed, that I really think we're now talking about, well, actually the public polling shows a minority of people think they should come home. That speaks volumes about the tone that the Prime Minister's using. Jacob, you've listened to the Prime Minister's tone. He's long believed this cohort are a bit different. I don't think it's just brand new and it's just about One Nation, but I think One Nation is part of the story. There's a real hardening of rhetoric on these things. It is not what we used to hear. Coalition's trying to push further and further. Government's holding their ground a little bit that they're not going to go willy-nilly changing laws, but I think we are all in the sort of collective territory of a very hard line on these people. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's right, Patricia. I do think seeing the footage, seeing the interviews, seeing the voices, seeing the faces, hearing the accents of, as you point out, children, does change it a little bit. It's not. It's easy to sort of follow the Prime Minister's very hard line of, you know, indifference. They made this crisis theirs. It's the parents who have to bear the consequences. They lie in the bed they made. But when you actually see the people, when you see the children, that's then a little trickier, because it's not just a faceless person that you're talking about. So I'll be interested to see if that softens a little bit.
PK, we got an incredibly surprising poll, I thought, this week in The Guardian, the Essential poll. And the figures in that, and this might go to why the parties, does go directly to why the parties are taking such a tough line on all of this. The figures are that I think it's something like 60% of Australians would be open to voting for One Nation at the next federal election. Nearly half of those were currently Labor voters. This, to me, is a whole new dimension on the rise of One Nation, isn't it?
Look, some people are questioning that polling, like they always do, but let's just go to the spirit of what you're saying. We are now in a territory where One Nation is not like the One Nation of the past, not in its ideas. I think its ideas are very similar, and I think we'd all agree there. Listen to the hardline rhetoric on Muslims. Compare that to the hardline rhetoric of 30 years ago on both Asians and Aboriginal people. To me, it's all the same.
Yep.
It's all hard, go hard on race and religion in the case of Muslims, seriously, right? However,
underpinned by a lack of actual policy that would work for running a country.
It's vibes and it's grievance. But we are now in a new paradigm around the world where, if I can be clear about, nationalism is cool, racism is becoming more normalised. We are talking, there was a speech, for instance, and comments the other day. Jacob, I'd love to hear your views on this. I was a little shocked. Josh Frydenberg even, right, who, you know, Nikki Savva said at the end of Insiders, you know, they've talked about still trying to even bring him in from the outside as a leader potentially in the future, said that, yes, maybe we need to have a discriminatory immigration policy that does discriminate even maybe on nations of where people come from if they're high risk. I mean, Jacob, we have shifted our rhetoric dramatically if someone normalises a comment like that. I spoke to Andrew Bragg, who's on the front bench now. He was actually elevated, interestingly, even though he's a moderate, by Angus Taylor. And he said, you know, he smacked back on that because the moderates still are worried about that. He said, no, we must have a non-discriminatory policy. It cannot be about countries or whatever. But Jacob, there are people, and Josh Frydenberg's not some historical capital C conservative, who are pushing some of these ideas now.
Yeah, let's have a debate about what Josh Frydenberg is or isn't on another show, ideologically speaking. I think his hard line comes from a different place, I suspect.
Yeah, I think so too, yeah.
I think the interesting thing about, and you mentioned it, you know, what's One Nation doing to the Labor vote, I think there's also a view, One Nation, yes, there's the immigration stuff, which is super hard line, but they've been very, very good at linking immigration to the core economic issues that bother people, and housing sits atop all of that. They've managed to link those two things together. The reason you have a housing problem is because of immigration, and that's really, really potent, I'm told, by some of the pollsters who've been looking at this stuff very closely. So it's wrong to sort of just say it's about immigration. There's an What's changed and what's made this more potent is there's a clear economic link now to that question. And so, yeah, there are attempts now to ratchet up, I guess, the policy response. And that proposal you just mentioned is a classic.
PK, just before we go, we were talking at the top of the podcast about the government trying relatively successfully to shift the focus away from the ISIS brides immigration debate to something more comfortable. But the PM made himself the story a bit this week, and a bit of a misstep, I think, by Anthony Albanese. He was on stage at a Herald Sun event in Melbourne, and they were playing that old favourite game, you know, the word association game. And the PM was treading pretty carefully at first. You know, they said Donald Trump and he said president, lame. They said Pauline Hanson, he said divisive. And then, PK, they said Grace Tame, and he said difficult, and social media has gone off.
Okay. Wow. So all of the words he used were really actually quite smart. You say lame, but actually smart. If
yeah.
You just
cautious.
Cautious, benign, yeah. And then Grace Tame gets mentioned. Now, let's remember who she was. Australian of the Year, survivor of child sexual abuse, right? Survivor has advocated for victims and
children in particular.
Children in particular, vulnerable children. She was at school when she was groomed. It's gross, right? It's revolting. And she has been like a lightning rod kind of character trying to push these issues. She has, in more recent times, I want to mention all this because the context matters,
yeah,
been quite radical, I think it's fair to say, on things like Gaza. She recently used that term, which is very contentious, very controversial, widely rebuked by a lot of Jewish people, which is globalize the intifada. So that context matters because when he was put the term Grace Tame, I think what the Prime Minister thought quickly was, oh, I want to distance myself from this woman because of that stuff. That's my own analysis, yeah, knowing him quite well. However, as a friend of mine was saying, because this has been the chatter around women, let me tell you, when he used the word difficult, and I say it with the passion in which I feel it, it is a loaded word used to deride and denigrate women who are pushy on issues, and it was so wrong. As someone said before, I'm not going to quote them, but they know who they are. You don't use difficult for any woman. You should just know that, yeah, especially as a progressive, because you remember he's from the progressive side of politics, Prime Minister. Do not use the word difficult for women, even if you secretly think it. The word he should have used is survivor. And then he could have added, so I'm giving fairness here. Oh, look, I don't agree with a lot of things she said on Gaza and other issues. However, she's a survivor of child sex abuse. End of story. You know what he's sending a message to, though? I don't think that was accidental at all. I mean, it was spur of the moment,
I think it was probably instinctive and he thought it through, I don't know.
He is sending a message to the Gen X men. If you look at the cesspit, which is social media, and for my sins I do, there is this hatred of women like Grace Tame, and he is honing into that. And I know a lot of people didn't like it. That's not to defend, and I want to be clear because I know how people mistake things on podcasts that globalize the intifada or critiquing the woman. You go critique her all you like. But difficult for a woman who stood up against a man who groomed her, don't say it.
Jacob, fantastic to have you. Thank you so much for detouring off the highway and popping into the Wagga studios there to talk to us about Farah. Thanks. See you soon, hey?
My pleasure. Take care.
That's it for the Party Room today, but we'll be answering your questions on a Question Time specific episode tomorrow. Fran, I'm very excited to hang out with you and make you answer all the questions. We've had some great questions come in, but you can send more to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
That's fun. And David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday with a deep dive into the capital gains tax. He's talking to former Reserve Bank Governor Bernie Fraser, who is no longer a fan of this tax. So remember, follow Politics Now. That's where you find this Party Room podcast on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.